Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, Bob Heil is with us. And you know, there are literally hundreds of microphones on the market, maybe 1,000. Why is it that Bob Heil's microphones sound really good, especially on human voice and drums and cymbals? Well, Bob Heil's going to be with us, and he's going to talk to me and Chris Tobin about why Heil microphones sound really good to the ear. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by the folks at Lavo. Lavo and the Crystal Clear Virtual Radio Console. It's the console with a multi-touch touchscreen interface. And by Direct Current Broadcast e-newsletter. Get Direct Current in your inbox every Thursday with technical pointers putting you and your facility at an advantage. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about everything from the microphone, the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower and everything in between. And we have got, I can't tell you how excited I am about this show. This is going to be a good one. One for the books. You're going to write down episode 335 and share it with your friends, because we're talking to Bob Heil about microphones. We'll bring Bob on in just a second here. First, we'll do our usual check-ins. I'm Kirk Harnack. I work for the folks at the Telos Alliance, so there is that slight bias going on there. And I own some radio stations, so there may be some bias there. And I guess that's about it. I've been an engineer and an announcer for a long, long time. Not very good at either one, but I sure enjoy trying. Now, coming to us, a much finer engineer and not a bad announcer either. It is Chris Tobin from somewhere in New Jersey. Hey, Chris, welcome in. New Jersey.
Hello, Kirk. Yes, I am not biased. I do not work for the Telos Alliance, and I do not own radio stations. But I do work in broadcast engineering and have enjoyed it for many years. Actually, now that I think of it, it's been a long time.
Hey, I wonder if we might cross the subject just real quick, if you had any initial thoughts on this. Not that we've had time to analyze it or hear all the details, but this morning it was announced that Entercom is merging with CBS Radio, and not a buyout, so Entercom's not going to enter into a bunch of debt, but they're merging. I don't understand all the MBA thingies that happen during a merger, but maybe you have a thought or two on this. Two very good radio companies, I might add.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a tax-free trust. They're doing the Morris reverse trust so that CBS doesn't incur the taxes, capital gains, I guess it would be, in the merger. And it's Entercom subsidiary will be taking over the assets. It's an asset sale of CBS. So there are some duplications in some markets. I shouldn't say duplications. They exceed the FCC limit for ownership of stations and markets. I think Boston, Seattle, L.A., if I read correctly. So, they hope to have everything wrapped up and moving right along by the second quarter of this year.
Interestingly, we don't have any CBS stations in the state of Tennessee between Memphis, Nashville, Knoxville, smaller market Bristol or Chattanooga. None, although there are Entercom stations in Memphis, Tennessee. In fact, we did a show from those stations year and a half ago or so. Anyway, it'll be interesting to see how it works out. People I've talked to are excited about having new colleagues that are well-respected. So it's, two companies that well-run, good engineering. I can't speak to the talent management. I know very little about that, but I know the engineering people all have a lot of respect for each other in these two big companies. So we'll see how it goes. All right, let's go ahead and bring in our guest. Is Bob Heil with Heil Sound. Bob, I'm just delighted and tickled that you were able to make it on the show today. Thanks for being here. How are you?
Well, thanks for inviting me. We've tried to do this several times, and I'm usually out somewhere where I'm not supposed to be or whatever. But it's really good to see you, and nice to be on the show and see what all we can stir up here in the next hour.
So, Bob, I guess you and I met several years ago, like 4 or 5 years ago, because we were both on the same podcast network together, the twit.tv network, where you still do the Ham Nation show. Before that, I was introduced to your products, microphones, by the folks at Broadcasters General Store in Ocala, Florida. Right. And I picked up a PR40 microphone. So, mm-hmm. You're still doing the podcast, the Ham Nation podcast.
We are. We're getting up to 300. I were 290 last night or something. Every Wednesday night we do it. And It's been a lot of fun and way beyond what I thought it would be. I did the first couple of shows and brought my best friend Joe Walsh on with me. Of course, Joe's a ham. A lot of people don't know that, but Joe is very technical. And he and I have been friends since the James Gang back in the mid-60s. And I figured, okay, Leo wanted us to do a couple shows. Okay, we'll do a couple. Well, here we are, almost 300 later. But we have a lot of fun and trying to bring amateur radio to those that that maybe haven't thought about it. But my whole deal is building. That's the trick. We're working on a project right now where we'll be building things. And that's what brought me to where I am in my careers, because I learned everything from ham radio. And what's so interesting about that, I was licensed back in 1956. One of my school chums was getting a ham radio license, and I'll go along. And so I did. I get on the air with that Harvey Wells that I still have and I used almost daily since 56. And I met this guy on the air, a weird sounding signal. I'm, what is this going? It was on 6 meters, VHF. And after a couple of nights, I kept playing around. He was on single sideband. And in 1956 on 50 megacycles, that was a big deal. Well, it turned out that I was his little guinea pig. He was building this thing, and I was 50 miles away from him, and every night I was intrigued. I'm a 15-year-old snot-nosed kid, and I'm going, yeah. But at that same time, I had become the organist at the Fox Theater in St. Louis.
This is amazing. I've seen you on with pictures with you and these beautiful multi-rank organs, and what an interesting talent that is. Tell us about that.
Well, so blessed. And what's crazy about it is my high school chum that got me into ham radio, his dad was the organist at the Baptist Church in Marissa, Illinois, a town of 2,000 people. And I'd go down there at night to play the organ with his dad, because I was an accordion player. I think everybody was issuing an accordion in 1950. And I got fascinated. My friend George was in the back room learning code. And so that's how that all started. And I was telling the guy on the radio, K0DGE, Larry, I said, I come into St. Louis every Wednesday, and I want to I want to come and see you. I said, yeah, do that. And he gave me his address and rolled up in front of this building, and it was KMOX. He was the chief engineer of CBS Radio.
Yeah,
and
St. Louis.
He took me under his wing, and I learned so much. I learned the color code. I learned how to solder. I learned how to punch a chassis with a Greenlee punch, building all these things for ham radio on the back benches of KMOX. Couldn't do it today, of course, but I'd been hanging around there all these years. And in 77, Robert Hyland, I'm sure that name's familiar to a lot of broadcast folks, Robert Hyland said, hey, kid, you've been around and around here for a long time. Why don't we put you on the other side of the microphone? And we did, and we were there for 25 years doing a thing called High Tech Heil. In 1977, I started going to all of the CES and NAB, all these different electronic shows that CBS would send me to. And we were bringing back news of the compact disc that was coming, and all kinds of things like the cell phone and things like that. It was an amazing time in my life, because I certainly am not a broadcaster, and yet I enjoyed bringing all of that great technology to the listeners. So all of this is congruent. I'm still playing the organ at the Fox. Well, I still play. So it's just been a crazy life.
So let's fast forward into how you got started in what stage sound. Was that kind of where we would pick up your career relating to what you do now?
Yeah, well, I got tired of playing. I was playing 6 nights a week and 4 hours a night. And I was like, oh, man. So I came back to my little town of Marissa, Illinois, 2,000 people in the coal fields of southern Illinois. And I started a little music shop. I figured, well, I'll teach organ or whatever. And luckily, I got a Hammond organ franchise. And I knew the guys at Hammond.
Yeah.
And I shouldn't have really been able to do that in coal fields because it should have been big cities. But I had worked for Hammond back in the 1959. I started. I was a demonstrator for them at the music conventions, and I got this franchise. And the next thing you know, I'm renting them to Kiel Auditorium in St. Louis, mm-hmm. where all kinds of groups were coming in. That was kind of the start of it, 1967, 68. But when I went there, Kurt, the PAs were terrible. They had little bitty columns to fill 19,000 seats. I'm going, that's not going to work. Yeah. And so one day it just happened. I went by the Fox. I hadn't been there in 3 or 4 years. And I rolled by to see my my old friend George Bales, who was the stage manager that used to push the button to bring the console up and down. And here were four A4s out in the alley. We're talking about Altec A4s, big dogs.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And I go, George, what are you doing? And he said, well, we're putting in a new PA. I said, what's all that stuff? Oh, he said, that the guys are going to pick it up, the trash man. I said, time out. To what? The trash man? I'm a ham. You don't throw anything away. I said, could I have them? Well, sure. Long story short, I brought them back to Marissa. I went and rented a truck, brought them back to Marissa, bought some Macintosh amps because I heard those were pretty good, and I bought a Langevin console and put this thing together. And it was a big hi-fi system. It was a four-way hi-fi system. It was beautiful. Well, I took it with me to some of these shows that we'd rent the Hammond organs, and it was the start of not only my career, but we woke up the world. I didn't know no one was doing it at that level. I was just a ham having fun. One thing about it, though, in the back up to the theater organ stuff, when I got to the Fox, that organ had not been played in 20 years. Stan Kahn was the organist there, and he kind of took me under his wing. But we had to voice and tune that Wurlitzer, 6,000 pipes from 1 inch, 32 foot. Now, tuning it is
not a big deal. It had 32-foot pipes for the lowest notes?
Yeah, 32-foot. Wow. It gives you 16 cycles.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
The deal is that I learned how to voice. Now, that's an art. Stan taught me how to voice. You have a whole rank of 91 trumpets, actual bells of trumpets, 1 inch long to those were about 8 foot long. And when you'd run up and down the keyboard of that particular sound, you wanted them to sound the same. One would be muffled, one would be bright, one would be bleh. You had to go in and roll lead, actually form that with the lip of the pipe so that the harmonics were all the same. That is an art. And I was blessed to be able to put in that position at 15 years old to learn how to listen. Not a lot of people listen. Listening is a mental process. Hearing, we all hear. Okay, I heard you. No. This is really dissecting what you're hearing. And little did I know that would really be a major focus of my careers later on, and it has been. But that's what started it all. And one of the promoters at one of the shows at Kiel said, hey, I got this little group out in Ohio. Would you like to take this on tour? We'd sure like to have this. This is great. Well, I've never been on tour before. I had a couple of roadies, and I said, let's go. So we go to Ohio for a little two-week run, and that band was the James Gang. And about two shows in, we found out that Joe Walsh and I were both ham radio operators. It changed our whole relationship because now Joe, he wants to do things, but he's playing. He's up front, but I'm right behind him. And he, many times, while he's playing, he'd come back, hey, do that, move that over. Oh, give this, do this, solder this over here, do that. And I mean, it was just a wonderful thing. And rock and roll didn't have the book yet. Nobody had done this yet. We were just out there scraping to get anything together. And we started a whole revolution. And I did a lot of little things. And then the big night came. The big night for not just Bob Hyde, the night for the industry. I get a call in 1970. It was from George Bales, the stage manager that had given me those speakers. "Hey, Heil, it's George. You still have those speakers?" And I said, "Yes, sir. Why?" "Well, I got this group in here tonight at the Fox, and they came in, and they don't have any PA." I said, "Really? What happened?"
Okay.
He said, "Well, I'll let him tell you, but it got confiscated by the FBI and the drug agents last night. Orleans. They were on a Midwest tour, and they were going to sneak out of California. The sound man, he owned the gear. Yeah. He was on probation.
Oh.
That group was the Grateful Dead. George handed the phone to Garcia, and I told him what I had, and I'll never forget. "You have Macintosh amplifiers." I mean, he's out in the middle of the Midwest. He figured, you know, they'd be lucky to even find a speaker, much less one of the most sophisticated sound systems he'd ever played through. And I didn't know. I'm just a ham. I'm just having fun. And you can go on the internet and put this into Google. The night rock and roll sound was born. Somebody wrote that article. I don't know the guy, but he would have had to been there. And we hit the front page of Billboard magazine because here's this little music shop in Marissa, Illinois that now has the Grateful Dead contract. We went on tour to finish the rest of that tour with them.
Those
gear was confiscated as well as the sound man. But we hit the front page of Billboard, and oh my gosh, everybody was calling us. And the best—I mean, we were doing all kinds of stuff, but with different groups. And but one day, I get this call from Peter Rudge, and that was from The Who, and they had come to America with big problems. They had new music. They came over here with little column speakers, and the first two shows were a disaster. And so we saved that whole thing. We were with them for 6 years, and it was just a crazy part of our life. But we certainly did bring some new technology, only because I'm fearless. I mean, I got a soldering iron. Townsend always pretty good. He says, "Leave the guy alone. He's got a soldering iron, and he makes me sound good, and he can drive the truck." And I did.
Wow,
crazy
wow,
times.
Wow.
Hey, and just Chris Tobin's going to have a question for you in a minute, but it's so interesting how our lives cross paths, because you mentioned the Hammond organs, and the house that I live in right here was owned since it was built by Otis Blackwell. And a lot of folks don't know Otis Blackwell, but they know his songs, right? He wrote over 1,000 songs, including "Love Me Tender," "Don't Be Cruel," "Great Balls of Fire," "I'm Your Handyman," that James Taylor made famous. And when my wife and I bought this house, left in it, and Otis died right in this, right upstairs from where I am now. Otis, the sellers couldn't get, they didn't know what to do with it. It was a Hammond CV organ. And Otis had played, unfortunately, it was in terrible condition. I ended up donating it to the Country Music Hall of Fame here in Nashville, and they graciously took it. Unfortunately, the Leslie speaker had been thrown away, so they didn't have that. But on the back of the organ was a little Dymo label maker label, and it said, and this you can just hear Otis's voice saying this, "Almost paid for." Almost, but and the other small world thing is Joe Walsh. So for a time, Joe Walsh lived in Memphis, and that was the same time that I was engineering at Rock 98 radio station in downtown Memphis. And our nighttime girl became friends with Joe and would invite him over. They'd sit, they'd chit chat. She'd put him on the air. So one night I came to the station and opened the door to my office, which was between the control room and the production room as a sound barrier. So the engineering office was between those two rooms. And there's Joe Walsh sitting at my desk. So, hey, Joe, how you doing? So, a little brush there. But I'm sorry, Chris Tobin, you had a question about this thing.
Which thing was that? I have many things to talk about.
The talk box. Remember? The Heil talk box.
The Heil talk box. For some reason, I draw a blank. Right, this. I'm not sure.
Okay. Ask Bob about the Heil talk box. How about that for intro?
I was going to say, wait a minute. I have plenty of questions. You're trying to seed me. You know. All right, Mr. Heil, can you tell me something about the talk box, please?
You're talking about this thing right here.
Let's switch to Bob's video.
The talk box started in 1939. Guess what? With another ham radio operator, Alvino Ray, who was playing guitar and married one of the King family. And what he did is he took one of the World War II microphones, your throat microphones, and they put it on his wife and put her behind a curtain. And then he took the output of his guitar and fed the microphone. So when he played guitar, it would modulate her vocal cords. Uh-huh. And that he had a couple of hit songs with that back in the late 30s, 40s. Well, that lay dormant until 1950 when right there in Nashville, Pete Drake picked that idea up and did it with a little 3-inch speaker and a funnel and called it his talking actuator. And he did a song called Forever Yours, which hit pretty good, pretty high on the hit parade, and it laid dormant. But he wouldn't build it for anybody or loan it to him or sell it, in nothing like that. It was in his studio. If you want to use it or something, you come here. Well, they did. Mm. George Harrison came there one time to record some things for his solo album. And he brought with him a little, I think he was 16-year-old guitar player, by the name of Peter Frampton. And very intrigued by that talk box. And it was stuck in his mind all those years. And you fast forward this. Joe and I came up with the idea, two ham radio operators, because he had played through that talking actuator to do Rocky Mountain Way in the studio. But he didn't have one or whatever, so when we got together to put Barnstorm together, we built one. We built, because he said, how are we going to do this, Bob? I got to have something loud. We can't use a little 3-inch speaker. So we took a 250 JBL 2482 driver and a couple of filters, and bingo, we had talk box. And I did it for Joe. I wasn't looking beyond Joe. But all of a sudden, people start calling us, hey, can we buy one of those? When Rocky Mountain Way became a pretty big hit. And so that's how we started all of that. And we built just literally tens of thousands of those over the years. But along about 1974, a guy by the name of Penny McCall, she was hanging out with Peter. She was married in our home. A lot of that happened where the UK artists would come to America, and they had to have a green card. They could be here for 6 months, and then they had to go back. What happened to that, Kurt? Well, we won't get into politics, but anyway, they couldn't be here without a green card. And anyway, if they got married, aha, and a lot of them did. And so she said, Bob, I got to have a Christmas present for Peter. What should I do? I said, watch your UPS box. And I sent her a talk box. You can go to my website, heilsound.com. There's a great video we did in Nashville. We sat down out at the rehearsal hall. And a really nice 15 minutes or so where Peter tells you all kinds of great stories about he and I and how we started together and did this and did that. But the talk box became very popular, and, you know, Bon Jovi and Slash, and it goes on forever. I hear them on country. I hear them on commercials. But we sold the rights to that in 1989 to Dunlop Electronics, and they're building it exactly the way we did. So it's still out there.
Wow! Wow! So, you know, since most of the viewers and listeners to this show, Bob, are broadcast engineers, I thought maybe we would spend a good part of the rest of the show talking about your education about microphone technology, and then, you know, what you have brought to the table about microphones. Would it be okay if we spend a good part of the rest of the show on that?
Oh, sure. Whatever you need. Yeah. Yep.
Well, talk to me about your early days, you know, stage microphones, what you found, what worked well for this or that, and then we'll get into more of, you know, today's designs in your line of microphones.
Well, what happened was I got tired. Again, I was on the road for about 10 years with all these groups, and here's you guys. I've never tasted beer or smoked a cigarette, but I'm running around with all these guys, but that's okay. I kept them sounding good. But I got tired of the road stuff and all that, and I came back in 1980 and kind of slowed down, sold all the road gear, and I started listening to my ham radio again. I thought, what is going on here? I hadn't been on the air for about 10 years. It was awful, real muffled, bassy, blah, blah, no articulation. What happened here? Well, what happened? The imports came in, solid state came in. We didn't have tubes. We didn't have really great articulation. And so I started building stuff for the amateur radio market, and boy, did we open a biggie there, because they hadn't had any one microphone company. Shure was there, Electrovoice was there, Turner was there. They all left it. There was nobody building ham radio mics. It was all just kind of a matching microphone that came with the transmitter. The only matching is it was painted the same color. The transmitter manufacturers do not, and even today, do not design their microphones. So it was pretty sick. And I came up with some very interesting microphones that the amateur radio genre just picked up like crazy, because it made them sound great. It all starts at the microphone. And I can't remember how many hundreds of thousands, but we just have gone through crazy stuff, built lots of headphones and headsets and things that were never done before. And I can let you hear one thing if you'd like to hear something kind of unique. This is how it all started. Let me unplug this. I'm a guy that I listen hard, but I also take a listen to and look at what's going to happen with it. Like, what is this thing going to do? Do we really need it? And all that kind of stuff. And what's everybody else doing? And that was the biggie. Nobody was doing anything. So let me do something. I'll unplug this, and I'll plug this in. And all right. It's not a bad sounding microphone. I'm not changing any equalization. It's all done in the microphones. And this is the most popular ham radio microphone. We started building this about, right around 1998, and it's still in production. It's called the Goldline. It's an amazing microphone. But where we turned heads and ears for the amateur radio crew is I have two elements in this microphone, and we can switch them. And you get into a noisy situation, and a lot of communications and ham radio is very noisy. And so what we do is flip the switch, and it's probably one of the worst sounding microphones ever. Well, why would you build it?
I built it because it really cuts through. You have no problem understanding what I'm saying. And this all comes about with a phone call I got about 1972 from Paul Klipsch, the father of the folded horn. Paul called in one day and said, "That you, Heil?" And I said, "Yes, sir. Who's this?" He says, "It's Klipsch here." And I'm going, this is God on the other end of his phone. "What can I do for you?" He said, "I want to come and see you. I want to fly up there and see what you're doing. You got that 20,000-watt PA?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "I want to come and see it." I figured, uh-oh, this ought to be something. He's going to cut me off at the knees. He didn't. All day long, "Why did you do this? Why did you do that?" Took me in his airplane back to Hope, Arkansas that night, took me out to his lab, and started showing me things, teaching me things. Go find out about this. Learn about Dr. Fletcher, Dr. Munson. Listen intently to what you're doing, and follow the Bell Lab studies of what your ears must hear to understand the difference of an F and an S and a P and a B. Because if it's a nice big old bassy thing, now I'm going to go here, but I'm going to do some equalization.
there's a lot of guys say, well, I'm going to buy me a damn condenser, and I'm going to be really big time. Well, you might be big time, but I can't understand what the hell you're saying. So we change all of that. We change it
by using different microphone elements, all dynamic. God put me on this earth to get rid of active elements. There's no necessary evil for condensers, and I prove it every day. I prove it every day. You got to let your ego go, and you just have to listen intently to what's going on with our new technology of dynamics. And it was Joe and I. Here we got to fast forward, though. I did all the ham radio stuff and still do. My wife, Sarah, owns the company. I just invent stuff here in this lab for them and answer all of the emails, hundreds a day, and do conventions and workshops, and I love all of that. But 2006 or so, maybe five, right in there, we're sitting at Joe's kitchen table, and he said, hey, Bob, you know that gold line you got? He said, I love that. He said, I'm going to start using that on stage. I said, oh, come on. Well, yeah. He said, I am, because it's better than my ball mic. I said, yeah, sure it is. He said, no, I'm telling you. So he takes me downstairs, and he does this. He unplugs this microphone, and he plugs this in. This is an SM58. I'm playing no games, by the way.
Yeah.
A lot of people think I'm doing stuff. No, I'm not. You have to equalize the bejesus out of some of these things to make them even halfway presentable. Well, I don't want to do that. I want to take a microphone, unplug this horrible thing. Oh, the other thing about it, don't get off axis. Oh, no, you got to suck it. You got to be right here. And it has no good rear rejection. Joe said, fix all that. He said, man, you remember that big antenna you had at one time? I had a 128 element, 2 meter array. It was 50 feet wide with all these elements and 50 feet high. It was crazy.
Oh, my goodness.
But I learned a lot from it. And it had great phasing ability, and we'll get into that in a minute. But what I did is I took what I learned from that, and we did this. This is the PR22. Uh-huh. This microphone it's just sensational for vocals. Paul Rogers had me build this for him. He wanted something to cut through the mix without any EQ because he said, my engineer doesn't always know what's going on. Joe says to me one day at the kitchen table, he says, Bob, you got to build me a big microphone. You know, the bigger things are, the better they sound. So I did. I did something that nobody's ever done. And I know this because I knew the engineer, Bob Schuline at Shure. They had never built and successfully a large diaphragm dynamic. Well, I did, and I took it to Joe. I did so much stuff with Joe because he was a great beta tester. He's a ham. He loved to play. And it didn't work very well. Why? Well, because it was like wings on a bird. It just fell. He said, well, make it thicker. I said, if I do that, it doesn't have any top end. And so he and I, two hams, no million-dollar studio, at a kitchen table in Studio City, we figured out how to tame it. Here it is. Let me unplug this. Right now, this is the microphone. You see it and hear it on all kinds of award shows, Carrie Underwood, Charlie Daniels, on and on and on and on and on, hundreds of them. And the reason is that it sounds so good. It has the right balance. You didn't hear that in the Shure microphone. You don't hear that in the Neumanns. You don't hear that in any other microphone. You got to equalize the damn thing. No, we're set level and right down the middle. But check this out. I am 90 degrees off. It's totally 90 degrees. I'm going to come around a full 180 degrees, and there's very little difference in the audio. So the vocalists love it. They don't have to suck the darn thing. They can move around, and it doesn't have that proximity problem, and you can move a full 90, and it's still there. But here's the biggie that we brought to the industry, and we still got engineers wondering, how the hell did you do that? This microphone, as all of our designs, has
40 decibel of rear rejection. So we don't have feedback problems from monitors. We don't have guitars screaming over the back of us. And I'm going to turn this thing backwards, and you will hear what I'm talking about. You won't hear. It's 40 dB down, and I'm talking in it. I have a lot of guys say, oh, I got a micro switch on. No, I don't. It still works. And I go back, 40 dB. Try that on your damn condenser. Try that on any of your Shures. Try that on your Neumanns. Try that on your Sennheisers. You can't. We brought new technology to this market. So then Joe says, well, you need to do something for me so when I record and take that big element. So I did. Little did I know that the PR40 was going to be a significant player in the broadcast industry. It has, I don't know how many thousands they've sold. I just invent stuff, but Sarah could tell you. Sirius Radio just bought about 100 of them. What'd they do with them? Let me let you hear what they did with them. I'm on a PR40 right now. Here's the lovable RE20.
Yeah.
And see, the only way you can make the RE20 work is you've got to equalize the crap out of it. I mean, you really have to work it and don't move off of it. I mean, if you move off, and it doesn't have any rejection. What's all this about? It's about marketing. It certainly doesn't work. Yeah. Well, I said, we're going to fix all that, and I'm going to go back now.
And they're just
you can't argue with the results of a PR40 or our microphones, because they're pretty much all the same. I only have like 3 or 4 different elements. That's it. And we put them in all kinds of things. But it's just been so much fun bringing new technology. This is it, folks. People say, well, where's all your meters and where are all of this and that? And, you know, you got to have a big million. No, my meters are these things on the side of my head. I'm serious. You don't need all that crap. I mean, when you build a microphone, you build it for people to listen to it. You don't look at scopes, and they don't bring along analyzers. It's the analyzation of what happens in their mind. And I know I'm just a crazy little guy from Southern Illinois, but we did something that did wake the world up, and we're very blessed by that.
Yeah? These microphones.
Hey, but Bob, if I can have you pause for a second, we have to hear from one of our sponsors right now. This is absolutely fascinating, and I've got a PR40 right here, and when we come back, maybe you can tell me a little bit more about what's going on inside. No proprietary information, but maybe you can tell us a bit more about why I like it as much as you say that I should, because it makes me sound really good, effortlessly. Our show, This Week in Radio Tech, episode 335, with Bob Heil, Chris Tobin is along too in New Jersey, is brought to you in part by the folks at Lavo. That's right. You may know me as a broadcast engineer, maybe an on-air guy, host of this show. Maybe if you've seen me doing TV weather in Nashville. Okay. What you don't know, or what you may not know, is that I used to sell broadcast equipment internationally. Now, that job took me all around the world, and I've seen a lot of broadcasting in a lot of countries. And the different, pretty imaginative ways that people do things, well, they're fascinating. And that's one of the reasons why I'm excited to introduce you to our sponsor, Lavo. That's LAWO.com. Now, Lavo is famous around the world for television, audio, and video, especially for high-profile event coverage like the Olympics, the World Cup Soccer, and the Grammy Awards. When the broadcast is mission-critical, you're very likely to find a Lavo console there. Now, you wouldn't believe how that stuff is built. It's over-engineered, redundant. Even their backups have backups. There are no do-overs in live event broadcasting, and dead air will kill your career. Now, maybe you're thinking, well, why should I care? I'm not doing TV. Most of the listeners of this show are probably radio engineers. Well, radio guys, you know, we hate dead air even more than TV guys do, which is why broadcasters like NPR, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, the BBC, to name a few, use Lavo radio consoles. Now, being this involved in TV and radio around the world means that Lavo thinks about the future a lot. And everybody knows that all types of media are converging on a common IP delivery platform. Lavo is ready for it with broadcast gear that can handle audio, video, and control of every studio device using a single integrated commercial off-the-shelf computer network. And after that, well, there's virtualization and broadcasting from the cloud. Lavo is building those tools right now. I think we'll see more at NAB. So if absolute bulletproof reliability, five nines of uptime, and future-proofing are important to you, well, yo it to yourself to find out more about Lavo. Here's how you check it out. Go to Lavo, that's LAWO.com, but put a slash twirt, T-W-I-R-T, on there, and you'll help us get a little bit of credit for that. Well, they'll know that you heard about their technology on This Week in Radio Tech, your favorite show. Or one of your favorites, that's Lavo, LAWO.com/twirt. Thanks a lot, Lavo, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. Well, Chris Tobin's along, and Bob Heil is our guest. Bob is the founder and I don't know if he's the CEO. Are you still the CEO of Heil Sound, or did you pass that duty on to your wife?
No, she is the president. I'm a CEO. I don't know what that all means.
I'm
just a gadgeteer, and I'm still inventing stuff and traveling around and doing a lot of – I love teaching this science. There's so many times I'll have a room full of broadcast engineers, and for some unknown reason, they missed the simple things. It's really neat to bring them to stuff that I was taught by Paul Klipsch. I also worked for DeRay Dolby for a couple of years. And it's just amazing what I've been able to accomplish. I hardly made it out of high school because I was playing the organ at the Fox and all over. And so I had a career ahead of me, but I never dreamed what was in front of me. It was great. You ask about how they work. I have a great demonstration.
Yeah.
Strictly right. Listening. I'm sorry about the video today. I don't know what's going on with the video today. It's crazy. But here, let me get everything all fired up here. I learned a lot of this from antennas. And I know immediately you're going to say, what does an antenna have to do with a microphone?
But you tell me.
And I have 5.5 acres here in the Ozarks. 3.5 of it's filled up with antennas. It was Joe that sitting at that kitchen table, we're talking about this big diaphragm, which we got to work, by the way. He said, you know, you turn that bigger antenna around and I couldn't hear you do that. Well, it's all about phase reversal. Mm-hmm. And if I put these two microphones together, they come up by 3 dB. I mean, it is very simple. You double it, you got 3 dB. And they both sound the same. It's not a big deal there. Well, I got this magic little plug.
Uh-oh.
What we're going to do is we're going to unplug this microphone.
I bet we're going to mix the two together in a hardwired fashion.
Wait a minute, Heil. It sounds the same. Yes, it does. And so the other. Okay, we're cool. All right? However, they're out of phase because this magic little plug. And 2's hooked to 3 and 3's hooked to 2. But it still works. It works just fine. But when I bring them together, here's what happens. Nothing. It's down. 40 dB. Way down. So philosophy.
Yeah. For our listeners and viewers, we do have a lot of automatic stuff on the feed here, so you may not have heard a big drop in volume, what Bob just did there, but I can assure you what Bob is feeding to his computer went down a lot when you add those two out-of-phase things in there. So I just want to let the listeners know you're hearing a lot of compression going on by the time it gets to you. Go ahead, Bob.
But that's how we did it, was every microphone. From the big dog $4,000 ones to the $30 ones. They just have little holes around the side of the element. Everybody's happy. And that's their phase reversal. That's not enough. We have the entire bottom of the element open 360 degrees, and it sits on a little pedestal. And so as the audio comes into there and flows up into the bottom of the element, we're getting intense amount of phase reversal. And that's how we did it. And it's a stellar part of the Heil Sound microphone line.
Does that imply that there are two elements in there, or is there just one moving coil in there?
Yeah, one, but it's big. It's an inch and a half.
Okay.
And
okay.
We also play with it a little bit on how we built that so we could get that pattern. We have our own pattern. I get these guys, well, is it cardioid? Hell no, I don't want cardioid. I want anything out the back. Why do you want cardioid?
Well, because my Tony, I had to have a cardioid. Well, I got a super cardioid.
That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. Who told you that? You know why you don't want it? Because it's got a spike out the back. I want nothing. Well, you're forced. All these big-time microphones that you think are so darn great, they all have it, so I'm going to have it, I guess. There isn't anything you can do about it except leave it alone, and we just prove to you why it should be replaced. And all of the Heil microphones have our own pattern. I call it a Heil pattern. It's Omni on the front and nothing out the back. And engineers love it. I get so many engineers. I see them at trade shows, at NAB. I see them at CES. I see them at the NAMM show we just left. And they say, wow, you make my job so easy. Because they don't have any feedback. They don't have reflections and all this because of that rear rejections. I love to get the condenser boys in front of me. I blow those guys out of the room, and it's like, whoa.
Okay,
whoa.
Bob, I'm not quite imagining how the pickup is in there, how the diaphragm is, but you tell me what's happening as I move the microphone around. So here I am talking in the front. It's an end address, and it sounds great. I always liked the way it sounded in my voice. I thought it makes me sound manly. So if I move off to the side here, the volume has gone way down. And I guess I'm hitting across. And then if I go toward the back, check, 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 check. I'm behind it, even if I'm right behind it like this. Check, check, check. And then spin it on around. There's the side again. And then right there's the front.
You pick up the room acoustics, too.
Yeah. And I've got a big computer monitor here. My voice is bouncing off, too. So.
Yeah. Sure. And you also get a lot, in your case, you got compression, and it's trying to bring the gain back with the limiters and so on. You do that straight through, and you can really hear the difference.
So you heard the same thing. See, I'm listening straight through to my mic. I'm with no compression whatsoever, and I heard an enormous difference everywhere except right on axis. It sounds great. Everywhere else, it's just way, way, way down. So you heard the same thing from me that I heard from you, and that is the effect of all the compression that's going on and some room acoustics and bounce, as I've got this big 27-inch reflector right here in front of my face. So, okay, all right. Trust us, folks. You get off axis, and it goes away. And that means for radio people like me, what do we got in radio stations? We got all kinds of noisemakers everywhere. You know, proper vocal recording booth, it's an isolated booth. There's nothing in there except maybe a light and a music stand and some copy and a microphone and a headphone jack, and that's it. But in a real radio station, you've got all these computers and used to have cart machines and reel-to-reels, but now we got just stuff everywhere. I've worked in radio stations where we had a window air conditioner 5 feet off to the right. And if you've got to make the room, if you can't make the room quieter, get a mic that makes it quieter. So I can talk into this mic and do next to no processing at all. If I'm reading a book, a book on tape for Audible, recording stuff for this show or for my employer, it's like this quiets the room and lets Kirk come through. Yeah. And that's what your whole idea was. Our good part.
Absolutely.
Of it, anyway.
And there again, it came from Joe, because one of the great artists of all times, and he's just sick of all the reflections and the feedback and crap, and that's what we wanted to do. But when does an artist get to talk to the designer and they do something about it? Oh, these big companies say, oh, yeah, we'll do that. They don't do anything about it. So it's a different situation with us, and we're just thrilled, just really thrilled about it.
I want to get Chris Tobin to ask a couple questions about. You make some other mics that are intended for guitar pickup or other acoustic instruments, for drum pickup. Mm-hmm. Chris, at your radio station, you do some live music there, which is not every radio station does that. Tell us about your situation, Chris Tobin, and then we'll have Bob respond to that.
We do a lot of live, acoustics, percussion, strings, you name it. We have it. We actually have a Hammond B in the performance studio along with Baby Grand Steinway, and we use various microphones, both condenser and dynamic, for different applications. We tend to use the dynamics on the percussion instruments. And one thought that came to mind when you were talking about your design, I'm going to assume that the cancellation. The out-of-phase cancellation is done mechanically with the back end of the element. Would it be true to say, with the PR40, if you're using it in a studio, in a broadcast environment, that if you try to process or EQ it, you actually would defeat the purpose of the way the element was designed to reproduce the person's sound, the voice?
I haven't heard that. No, I really haven't, because usually you don't need to do all of that. That's where things have to change, because you don't need all of that. The microphone is doing so much for you, and that works. I mean, you don't have all this crap coming in from the back. It's a whole different world. And we've worked with several really great engineers. One of them is right there in Nashville. It's Charlie Daniels' engineer, Bob Workman. We came up with the PR30. This microphone is being used to record symphonies, Steinway pianos, oboes, you name it, and it's the best electric guitar microphone ever built. And it's that large dynamic with this great rejection. Bob Workman has about 20 of these on his stage, and he called me a couple of years ago. He said, "Hey, what's in the bottom of this thing?" And I said, "Not much, nothing. There's a plate here." He said, "Well, can we cut it in half?" I said, "Absolutely." So we did. And we have a thing called the PR31BW. That's its model name for Bob Workman. And we take one of these and put it on TomTom. We have our own special mount, because there again, the mounts aren't very good. We have our own special mount on the TomTom. Right beside it, we have one turned up, and we do an underhead cymbal. These two microphones are 6 inches apart, and when you solo them on the console, you do not hear the cymbal with the tom, and you do not hear the tom from the cymbal. And when I tell people that, they say, "That's not possible." Well, you can believe what you want, but we prove it. If you do that, you'll say, "Wow." There's tremendous walls put between these microphones because of my rejection. And the best instrument mic is a PR30 or 31, and we just hear it all the time. People have been using condensers and all these overly sensitive things, and they finally, because I beat up on them so much, and they said, "That guy's gonna be crazy." And when they try it, it's like, "Oh my God." And that's the whole deal, is that it's a new technology. You don't need phantom power. You don't need all this sensitivity, because that's what causes the problem. And we make drummers really happy, and especially their engineers, because now you can finally listen to a live band and hear the cymbals. I go to hear bands, and I'll walk out on most of them. I never hear the cymbals through the PA. Why? Because they're using the damn condenser 4 foot above the cymbal. They can't get it any closer because it's going to overload it. So what do you hear? Guitars, the piano, the whatever. You never hear the cymbal. Well, now we put this baby right under the cymbal, right next to the tom-tom. You don't hear either. You hear what you're supposed to. And it brings a whole new thought of how you do things because of the new microphone technology that we've brought to the industry. It's pretty simple.
That's exactly what I expected. That's what I was working with someone several months ago with the PR40. Yeah, a couple of PR40s in a studio environment, and they told me they didn't like the way it sounded. There was a problem, and I said, "Well, I own a PR40, and I seem to like it. Works very well. It does exactly as advertised, and then some." And now I realize, from your description of your design and the approach you took, now I know exactly why it didn't sound right. He was trying to add EQ along with compression and everything else like you traditionally do with the, we'll say, inferior microphones, and it altered the sound. It's similar to what I discovered years ago with an SM5B in a couple of broadcast facilities many, many years ago for the Shure SM5B. Same thing. If you just left it plain, it worked very well by itself. But if you started, you know, dicking around, so to speak, with the EQ, things just got out of hand. So you've confirmed what I suspected was the problem, and I appreciate that. And it's funny how you're absolutely right. What's that?
You have some Leslie speakers. There's the best Leslie speaker microphone in the world. We actually put a pair of them inside, mount them permanently inside, 180 degrees out. And as that baby spins around, oh, buddy, it sounds so good. And then we use a PA40 on the bottom. It's just great. Yeah. It's just great.
That's excellent. Wow. So it's an excellent design and thought process. I definitely appreciate it.
Bob, we're getting close to being out of time. I wonder if you could talk for a moment about headsets. And I know you make headsets appropriate for amateur radio. Is one of those models appropriate for a sports broadcaster or someone who needs to be hands-free with that microphone really close to their mouth pretty much the time? You got something like that?
This is our latest headset called the Pro 7. There's a lot of guys out there trying to develop a copy of the David Clark, and they've done a pretty poor job of it. Oh, boy. Well, we did it, but it's really good. What I did is I went back to the Paul Klipsch days when he taught me how to tune a speaker and a cavity together for speakers. You take the speaker outside, you do a free air cone resonance, and then you build the cavity. You got it. Everybody matches. Well, I did that in this headphone. I took the speaker, and it's a very high-quality speaker. Most of these things, if you're, it's just a headset. No, it's got to sound really good. It's got to have good articulation, a good frequency response. And we then tuned the cavity to the free air cone resonance. It's just gorgeous. Wow. Then we've got the gel cups. This thing's doing minus 26 dB passive. I went the active route for a while, and you know how it is, the batteries and this and that. This thing is amazing. But what we did here, I have interchangeable elements. Take the two little screws out, and you can interchange the elements. We are now working on, and hope to have this done by this summer, a full-range broadcast element. These are for amateur radio. You heard the two elements a while ago on the microphone. That's what's in here. Yeah. It really cut through the pileup. It also has a left-side balance, so if you're hard of hearing on one side or the other, you can balance. And we are the only headset in the world, and we've built over 150,000 of them in the last years, that has phase reversal. Why would you need phase reversal? Because in communications, if you have a tough time hearing somebody, reverse the phase, and we can actually move signals around in our head acoustically. Uh-huh. And I learned that from my many years in the hi-fi, the home theater industry. And it's just cool to be able to have something that the technology allows you to do things you never done before. But the Pro 7 is it's really been a great product for us, and next will be the broadcast element. So it's coming. We did this. Bob Workman was the guy that he just several years ago said, "You have to build me a headset." Well, we did the Pro 3. It's a great headset. I think it's only $100, but it's got phase reversal on it. And it really makes a difference. And it all folds up in a little ball, and it comes with three different cables. They're interchangeable. One that'll fit into an iPhone, because you can't put everything in that little rounded end. A straight cord and a coil cord. And so we listen to our users, and we do things that they want. And many times it becomes a very viable product, and we're so blessed to have all that happening. So that's pretty much what's going on, and Sarah's got things rocking and rolling, and we're very happy to be able to bring all this new technology that I learned from some of the masters.
Bob, if you'll hang on, we got a final word coming up from you and Chris in just a moment. Our show is brought to you This Week in Radio Tech, episode 335, with Chris Tobin along here. I'm Kirk Harnack, and Bob Heil is our guest. Our show is brought to you in part by the folks at the Telos Alliance and this awesome weekly newsletter, Direct Current.
Not much in the paper today, is there?
Not much. Seems tough to stay informed, you know?
Like we're missing out on stuff, important stuff.
Yeah, feels like week-old news, yesterday's stories. Half the tech stuff in here seems out of date by time I see it.
What Kirk doesn't know is I'm way ahead of everyone else around here. Every Thursday, I get this newsletter in my email. It's Direct Current. The folks at the Telos Alliance publish this.
What Joe doesn't know is I keep one step ahead of the radio guys in this market. Every Thursday, I get Direct Current from the folks at the Telos Alliance. It's a free newsletter about radio engineering, audio, streaming, studios, everything.
Thursday afternoons, we have our department head meeting. I look like a genius thanks to the knowledge, updates, and advice in Direct Current. Sometimes I wonder if I should tell Kirk about Direct Current. Might help him out.
I wonder if I should let Joe in on my secret. He could use a little help sometimes.
Get Direct Current in your inbox every Thursday. Read profiles of engineers and newsmakers in the broadcast community. Get technical pointers putting you and your facility at an advantage. Important industry news and views. Plus, you'll be up to date on Telos Omnia Axia and ZipStream products. It's all here in the Direct Current newsletter. Subscribe online at telosalliance.com/directcurrent. That's telosalliance.com/directcurrent.
I sure thank the folks, my friends and colleagues at the Telos Alliance for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. It's very important to me, and it should be important to you, too, because they really do help make it possible to pay the bills that have to get paid. All right, we just got a minute to wrap it up. Bob, is there any last little tidbit you'd like to leave us with?
Mm-hmm. I am doing a weekly show in Nashville. It's called Theater Organ from the Ozarks, 8 o'clock Central on WTWW. It's a 200,000-watt shortwave station. Ted Randall and his family really got some things rocking and rolling down there.
Yeah.
And we also cast Ham Nation on that thing on Wednesday night. And it's on 5.085 megacycles. But I do that every Saturday night, and it's a lot of fun. I have a wonderful theater organ here in my studio out in the next building. But if you like theater organ music, why, look it up. WTWW is their station, and they also live stream that. But, yep, we have a lot of fun playing the organ. I play a lot of shows around the country for theaters and stuff. Still playing. Awesome.
And you also do the Ham Nation show on the twit.tv network. We'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Still writing lots of books. Just got another one called Ham Radio Handbook. And so I do a lot of this stuff. It just keeps me out of the tavern, Kirk.
Chris Tobin, sometimes you do the show from the tavern. You got a final word for us quickly, Chris?
Real quick, since we're talking cables and microphones and things of that sort, don't forget to have a cable tester available in the studios or on the road, and make sure you have a test cable, one that's calibrated, we'll call it, that you know is a known entity, baseline, and then you have your cable tester. This is one by Worldwind. It's a DCT9. So the reason why you have a baseline cable is because if you're testing something, you don't know what's going on with it. At least with this cable, you know what to expect. You've got the box working. You can plug it in, and you know what you should be getting. So just like you did in chemistry class, you have a baseline before you did the chemical analysis, or in physics, you have a baseline before you blew up the little vacuum chamber. Same thing here. So just a quick tip. And if you need to carry it around, you can always get one of those old-fashioned plastic cases from, like, say, a glipped hard drive storage kit. Take out the foam, right, and you can carry this around. And be sure to label it so you know exactly what's inside.
That's
a quick tip. Quick tip, because I only say this because, again, I worked with somebody who's learning how to do broadcast and stuff, and it was fascinating to discover what they thought was the right way to do cable testing. I'll leave it at that.
Label stuff. And my tip, as I've said before, Brother P-Touch does nice labels.
Yes.
Or you can use a Sharpie, too, but, Brother looks better. Bob Heil, we got to go. Thank you so much for joining us. I certainly appreciate you.
Thank you. I'm sorry the video was so terrible. I don't know what's going on with the satellite feed today, but it is. But, hey, we're here. The audio worked, and we'll come back again someday. Thanks, everybody. You can find me at heilsound.com, and there's an email thing there, info@heil. Just I'll be here. If we got any questions, we'll be there to answer them.
And we'll have links in the show as well. I'm looking forward to trying out the Pro 7 headset, especially when you get the broadcast mic capsule for it. That's going to be really good. I'd love to try that out. And Chris Tobin, thank you for being here from New Jersey and your place of employment. Good to have you here.
Thank you. No problem. My pleasure.
All right. Hey, you know, I forgot to look up what's coming up next week. Give me a second here, and we'll see who's who's on the big shoe next week. It's hard to top Bob Heil, but next week, we've got a guy who knows all about this craft of hooking audio over IP stuff together with different standards, like hooking Dante to QLAN to Ravenna to Livewire to AES-67. Patrick Kalaney with Yamaha is going to be on the show with us next week. So thanks a lot. Suncast, thank you very much for producing our show. Bob, thanks to Bob Heil and Chris Tobin. And we'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye, everybody.